91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. In our increasingly computer-mediated world of emails, text messages, and social media, is there still value in face-to-face contact? Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Developmental psychologist and journalist Susan Pinker argues that electronic communication can never replace our deeply rooted and fundamentally human need for social interaction and connection. She's the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Pinker even goes so far as to say that human contact can ward off disease, educate our children, help us succeed in business, and increase our lifespan. We'll learn more in moments on Topical Currents after the news.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour, we visit with developmental psychologist and journalist Susan Pinker. Her previous book is the acclaimed The Sexual Paradox, and she has a new one.
And we'll discuss her scientific exploration of how healthy social bonds are dependent on personal contact, what's considered FaceTime, and we're not talking about what you do with your iPhone or your iPad, right? Susan Pinker's latest book is The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter.
I've accidentally hit that FaceTime. Oh, boy, what a shock.
Okay, and Susan Pinker joins us from Montreal. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for inviting me today.
Sorry we couldn't hook up that Skype. You use that Skype quite a bit in your book, you say.
Well, I actually don't use it as much as some other people, but it's definitely one of the tools that's at my disposal when I want to connect with people who are not geographically close to me.
So, Susan, let's begin with an explanation of the village effect and why that number 150 is the ideal number for a village population.
Well, the village effect is a metaphor that I'm using for the kind of social contact that we all need to survive and thrive. So most people don't know, I certainly didn't know, that if you gather together with a circle of friends to eat or share gossip or play cards, you'll live an average of 2 to 15 years longer, because essentially face-to-face contact is protective. It improves your resilience, it improves your learning and memory, and it helps you in ways that most people were not aware of, especially in the era of digital connection.
There are a lot of statistics in the book about lifespans and health effects. So how were those, was that data ascertained?
Well, I'm actually synthesizing all the data and pulling it together with human stories that touched me, really. So this is about science through stories, and there are many studies. Some of them, a lot of the really good ones, are demographic studies that take measurements of a whole village, I would say, or a whole town, and then follow people as they age through time. And what they, you know, because you essentially can't take people and do an experiment that you can do with rats, you know, divide them into two equal groups and deprive some people of social contact and allow people, other people, their friends and family. That wouldn't be ethical. But what you can do is measure everything about them and then follow them ahead into time and see what is most predictive of their health and well-being. And some researchers have done just that with absolutely amazing results.
Well, it seems almost too good to be true. I mean, you say that human contact actually helps us ward off some diseases like Alzheimer's or survive others like breast cancer due to these psychological and biological events that take place within our bodies. So would you explain what events those are and tell us about some of the research?
Yes. Well, you know, to start off in the small range, you know, when you connect with somebody face-to-face, there's a whole cascade of biological events that occur. You know, what we're aware of, or maybe it flies under our radar, is that we make eye contact, our body movements become synchronized, there may be like a little pat or a fist bump or, you know, a high five, and our the way that we speak becomes synchronized, that what we call prosody. And all these little clues elicit the release of oxytocin, which is a hormone that damps down stress in the immediate term, but in the long term kind of helps to trigger how certain cells and genes play out over time and has an impact on, for example, how healthy we are into the future. There's also a releasing effect on certain neurotransmitters that affect how we deal with stress and certain, I guess, viral loads. So it's something that was quite new to me. In other words, we've known for, I guess, about at least 10, 15 years that people who have richer social lives tend to live longer. That we've known for at least, as I say, a decade. But what we didn't know were the mechanisms of how that works. And that's only now starting to be revealed, that what happens between people that we connect with face-to-face, it actually plays out on our cells and our bodies, and that the absence of that contact, and that's, I think, one of the most critical points, leaves like a lonely fingerprint on every cell. So people who feel isolated or alone, and there's so many more of us than there used to be, actually are having a direct impact on their ability to survive, you know, viruses and infections and more serious assaults on our health, for example, like, you know, cancer or heart disease. Mm.
Well, what sort of research led to the conclusion that more FaceTime and personal relations can increase someone's IQ and also breast cancer severity? Where's the data?
Yeah, well, those are two completely different areas. So where would you like me to begin?
Okay, IQ.
Okay, now IQ, that's really, the research for that comes from two main areas. One is from family meals. Essentially, there's nothing as predictive of a kid's vocabulary and school performance and IQ as how many times they eat together with their family without screens. And many experts in the field, myself included, posit that the reason for this is not because of how much broccoli you're eating, but actually because of what's happening between people as they're connecting at the table, because they're face-to-face, and essentially children and teenagers' brains are built to interact in person face-to-face, and so that forced structured interaction has a huge impact on how well they communicate, how well they do in school, and how well they do in IQ tests. And the second area that predicts IQ is really breastfeeding. There's a huge volume of research that breastfed kids do better on all sorts of factors, and one of them is IQ. And essentially, my view of that is the reason is that it's the slow food movement for babies. Mothers are spending much more time face-to-face with their babies, with their faces about a foot to 18 inches apart. And all that time, most mothers are communicating, rocking, singing to their babies, and this has an impact on their neural development. So I think that I was a bit tongue-in-cheek when saying it increases IQ, because really it's not so much that face-to-face contact increases IQ as that it increases kids' ability to learn.
But you just said that breastfeeding increases IQ.
It does. It does. Well, that's where the data are. But essentially, I'm more concerned with not kind of raw measures of how much you already know, but your ability to learn and keep and use information into the future. And that's where face-to-face contact really comes into play, because face-to-face contact, not just for kids, but for older adults as well, is one of the reasons why I wrote this book. At the end of my last book, which was about sex differences, I discovered something interesting. It was a puzzle to me, actually. Not only do men everywhere in the world live shorter lifespans than women do, or everywhere in the developed world, about 5 to 7 years shorter. In other words, women live longer lifespans. Women tend to have more active and involved social networks. But also, I discovered at the end of the last book that people with larger face-to-face social networks were less likely to have dementia. And I wondered, that's where I started. I thought, what is the relationship between those two? And it turns out that there is a relationship between how often you get out of your room or your house and you socialize with people, not only your intimate friends and family, but the larger world. And that was what was really amazing and surprising to me, that it was not only our close bonds that matter, but the medium-range bonds, the people that you would meet when you, you know, go buy your newspaper at the corner, or when, you know, every day if you go for a coffee at the same place, those people that you meet there, or the ones you cross pass with in your neighborhood. All these people, that those diverse types of social contact are as important as those intimate bonds.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you were asking about data. One of the most persuasive studies that I encountered was done by a woman named Julianne Holt-Lunstad and her team at Brigham Young University. And they did a meta-analysis that was published in 2010 where 309,000 subjects were followed over time. In other words, they measured everything about them, you know, whether they smoked, how much exercise they got, what their weight was, how much alcohol they consumed, whether they got flu vaccines, whether they'd had a heart attack, whether they were in rehabilitation for heart attack, on and on, you know, whether they were in drug treatment for hypertension, whether the air they were breathing was clean or not. And they followed them over time to see what would happen to them 7.5 years hence. What would be the most predictive of who would still be alive in 7.5 years? And I was just blown away by the results, and they weren't what I expected, which is that one of the smallest impacts on how long we will live is air pollution. That really surprised me. Next came whether we were treated for hypertension. Next after that was BMI, how lean or obese we were. And, of course, everybody knows there's been a huge effort to get people aware of the huge rate of obesity in the United States. But, you know, those are the three, I guess, weakest predictors of longevity. The three strongest predictors of longevity were social relationships, meaning how integrated you are into your community, and your social support, meaning those are your intimate connections, and whether you smoke more than 15 cigarettes a day. And the amazing thing is that social relationships, both types, were more powerful predictors of longevity than cigarette smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that. I certainly didn't.
No. Surprising. We're speaking with Susan Pinker. She's a developmental psychologist and journalist who's written The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. We need to take a short break on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we return 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and developmental psychologist and journalist Susan Pinker. We're discussing her book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Bonnie?
Yeah, well, if you're someone who thrives on face-to-face interactions, and we don't mean FaceTime on your digital device, or do you prefer to connect digitally, and if you find that your busy life leaves you little time for face-to-face interactions, how that's affecting you, we'd love to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org. Susan, I know you're familiar with Mark Dunkelman because I know you did that Diane Rehm show with him. We had him on from Brown University. And, of course, he wrote The Vanishing Neighbor. And he talks about that loss of middle ring relationships as the crux of the problem. Is that, I guess, what you're calling the weak bonds and how important they are in our lives?
Yes, and I would say that very few of us are aware of how much they've kind of faded away in our day-to-day lives. And, you know, you just mentioned before about whether you thrive on FaceTime or not. And interestingly, there are individual differences about how much time people need to interact. Mm-hmm. And there's some evidence even that there's a powerful genetic component to that. You know, some people need more, some people need less, but we all need some, just because it's a biological appetite, like, you know, food or drink or sleep or sex. So it's not whether you need it or not, it's how much. And interestingly, because that whole middle layer has fallen away for many of us, because many of us now shop online and some of us go to school and work online, and we don't really need to get out there and walk or take the bus anywhere and meet people to do what we need to do, that middle layer of relationships doesn't exist for many people. And in fact, a lot more people now even live alone than used to. There's a 300% increase of solo living for Americans just in the last 40 years. So many people, not only do they not have to meet people during their day, they don't meet any people at all.
Well, you say that being married significantly reduces our chances of being hospitalized, developing gum disease, going to jail, and dying in a car accident. What is this research?
Well, it's hard to just, it's a chapter that has probably, I don't know, 45 or 50 studies in it.
Right.
But to summarize it, what's really interesting about the research is that if you're married, essentially, you have a built-in social interaction. So this is hugely powerful, especially for men, because for men, just being married or not is highly predictive of how long they'll live. For women, it's not whether they're married, it's the quality of the relationship that matters. So for women, if they have a difficult or hostile relationship in their marriage, this is not only not productive for their health, it is damaging to their health.
But
whereas
so
for men, it's really just whether they have a wife or a partner or not that matters,
which is very interesting. But with 50% of marriages failing, isn't marriage typically one of the most stressful aspects of life?
Well, actually, the rate of divorce is going down quite a lot, so it's no longer 50%. That's an old statistic. And not really. I mean, the research on marriage is very persuasive, and in fact, not only do married people, especially men, live much longer than single people, something like, some incredible statistic, I'm going to look for it here, but something like 20 years longer on average. I'm going to look for it and get back to you on that as I have it on my desk here. But they live longer than people who just live together. It's not so much the piece of paper, but the level of commitment, where it's as if you know somebody has your back, so that women who are in good marriages, for example, they sleep better. They wake up less at night. They have less back pain. They have fewer headaches. They have less chronic disease. So it's much more powerful than I think anybody ever thought it was.
If you would like to join in the conversation today, we're talking about connection, face-to-face connection. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email us, radio@wlrn.org. Susan, you talk about the workplace, and of course, most of our communications are digital these days in the workplace, just because in the interest of time. But you say we should take frequent breaks to socialize, and say that coordinated coffee breaks, for example, increase work productivity. But in most work environments, this is frowned upon as wasting time and discouraged, if not prohibited.
Yeah, I think that in general, people have neglected the power of face-to-face contact, and this is especially true in business because it was considered a soft science. It wasn't often measured, but when now people are starting to measure it, there's a little device, believe it or not, it's a digital device that you wear around your neck, and it looks like an iPhone, and a scientist named Ben Weber has started to use it to measure who talks to whom in the workplace, how much are they coordinated, in other words, how much are they in sync with each other, mm-hmm. and what is the impact on their productivity? So one of the most interesting studies that I quote in the book is he studied 25,000 call center agents, and he put these badges, these sociometric badges, he calls them, on them to track who was talking to who on their breaks. Now, traditionally in call centers, which is a very discouraging, alienating type of work in my view, people took staggered breaks. In other words, they were never on break with their teammates. But what Ben Weber did is he tested the idea, what would happen if your whole team went on break together? And he discovered that when he equipped everybody with these sociometric badges to track who was talking to whom, he discovered that the people who went on break with their teammates socialized more in a synchronous way, and talked to other people more. And when they went back to work, they were more productive. So when he did an experiment and compared the staggered breaks to the coordinated breaks, that simple change, just getting people to take a break with their teammates, induced the village effect, and it improved weak teams' performance by 20%.
Does a coordinated break mean you have to go?
That's a good question.
I'd hate to be in the middle of a script and say, oh, I've got to go on a coffee break.
I actually don't know the answer to that question. But I imagine that it's such demanding, exhausting work that if you have a mandated break, you'll take it. But I don't know, for example, if that's the case. What I do know, it's one of many studies and many workplaces that is starting to put this into practice. For example, Google has designed the Googleplex essentially around face-to-face contact so that you're never more than a few seconds away from anybody else who works for the outfit, because they found that those kind of casual encounters prompted creative ideas and sparked kind of new projects that were, of course, monetized. So it's quite interesting. I think in business in general, people equate all types of social contact, so a text and an email and a Skype call and being in person are considered equivalent, but that's not what the science is telling us. And what's really interesting that I never knew, which is that if you don't interact with somebody face-to-face, then your relationship with that person decays. And so within 18 months to 5 years' time, depending on the strength of your relationship, your slot in that person's social network will have disappeared and been replaced by somebody else. So it's kind of like something in your fridge that goes off unless you take it out and look at it and interact with it. You know, most of us think like, he's my Facebook friend, or,
right,
we email together and that should be good enough. But no, it's not good enough. And certainly it's not good enough in business. This is something that I think people higher up on the echelons are aware of, and that's why they're on airplanes all the time.
Well, can't digital relationships for some people be a strengthening factor?
That's a great question, and I think you're right, it can be. Essentially, there's something that social scientists call the rich get richer and the poor get poorer phenomenon, which is that some of us are really good at making new relationships, grooming them, keeping those relationships alive. And for those of us, most of whom are extroverts, then we just use our digital devices to get together with our people more and to share more information with them. So yes, it does strengthen those relationships. The problem is that for more introverted people, or for people who find it difficult to communicate for various reasons, that sometimes the digital is displacing the face-to-face, and people kind of conflate the two. And for those, the poor get poorer. So, for example, teenagers who have difficulty making new friends or communicating with people, or who for some reason are isolated, often turn to digital media, to online media, for companionship, much the way I think people used to turn to the television for company in past years. And what happens is that when they do that, they feel more alienated. In other words, it makes them feel more lonely and left out and depressed than they were before. It doesn't have the effect that we want it to have.
I suppose some of this research is sort of confirmed in other primates?
Yes, it is. Of course, other primates don't usually use iPhones, right? But other primates...
Not
for example,
yet.
No, right. So the great apes, for example, spend way more of their daytime, the time when they're awake, interacting with people face-to-face. And what we've learned from other primates is that humans have evolved for face-to-face contact, especially for critical things like establishing trust. You know, who can you trust? Who is not trustworthy? And that when we compare, for example, the digital connection with face-to-face, I think digital connections are great for sharing information. They're great for searching for information. They're fabulous for logistics, but they're just not as good as the face-to-face for deepening human connections, for solving complex human problems, and kind of forming lasting bonds. So that's why one of the points I make in The Village Effect is that you need your village, and you can use your digital devices to amplify your relationships outside, but not to replace them.
I can understand that, but I was thinking, Susan, you know, as cities become more and more populated, or as they did become more populated, independent of the advent of the internet, wasn't there already a tendency to move away from the idea of a village? I mean, I lived in New York for many years, and I remember not knowing, you know, even in college, the people down the hall, or in my apartment in New York, the people across the hall.
Yes, you're right that it's absolutely not correct to think of our digital devices as causing this problem. You know, I think this is a discussion that I think is critical to have right now because there are so many Americans who are lonely, and I mean desperately lonely. Mm-hmm. About 20% of Americans say they have nobody to talk to now. And that's quite a huge number. About 35 years ago, that number was something like 8%. There are three times as many adults now who are socially isolated and who are unhappy about it. And it's not just the digital connection that is causing that. I think it's also because we're a much more mobile society. I think it's also that more people, as I mentioned before, are living alone than used to. I think we're living longer lives. And if you live a long life, it means that your spouse and close friends may predecease you and leave you on your own. So some good things can spark some bad things, but essentially, the most lonely group in America now are the middle-aged, meaning people in their 40s. And the reasons are not just because of the digital connection, but because they're working long hours. Many of them are working not in cities, but in suburbs or exurbs where they have long commutes. And because I think there's a general feeling of a time crunch, and so, you know, Facebook and Twitter and other online devices are like the fast food of social connection. They kind of give us that quick hit with a lot of calories in very short amount of time. But what I'm arguing, both through stories and a lot of evidence, is it's not at all the same thing. It's like equating, you know, having a quick candy bar on the go with sitting down and having a Thanksgiving meal with your, you know, mother's or grandmother's recipes and spending a couple of hours cooking and socializing. They're not at all the same thing, even though the hit of calories may be exactly identical. So, you know, I agree with you that it's not just our devices that are doing this to us. There are many, many things. And I would actually take issue with the fact that people in cities can't live in villages. Because I'm not talking about a village as a real village.
Right, right.
It's a metaphor.
I understand.
Right? So, right. In fact, people who live in New York, many of them do have this metaphorical village. In other words, they go down to the shop and buy their fruits and vegetables more often than they get in their cars. Many New Yorkers don't even have cars.
Oh, you're right.
Right? Pardon me?
Of course, that's true.
Yeah, and they walk to the subway station. They see the same people on the subway every day. They may, you know, have the same kind of paths that they walk every day or go to the same cafes. And this is less likely to happen, I think, in suburbs or exurbs than it is in a dense city like New York.
Right. We're speaking with Susan Pinker. She's a developmental psychologist and journalist. She's written The Village Effect. And one more break, and we'll be right back.
And 37 minutes past 1 o'clock, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Susan Pinker. We're talking about her book, The Village Effect. And we're also taking calls, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, if you're a little shy, radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. First caller, we have Miriam in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Miriam. Hi.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm excited to be on because I live in Los Angeles and I'm just visiting Miami, but I never get on in Los Angeles. I just wanted to say something to Mr. Cooper in reference to something he said before, and it's about the FaceTime. And when he said, "You hit it by mistake," and what a shock, I just felt wonderful because for a woman, especially, and, you know, we won't mention the word vain, I'm 75. I don't really look 75, but I'm not hideous. And I'm hideous on FaceTime, and I don't want FaceTime. So I'm just hoping other people, or have hoped other people, have felt that way. And now I know at least someone has, but maybe not for the same reason. Thank you, though. That's all I was going to say.
Well, it was a surprise.
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Miriam. Enjoy your stay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, let's turn to children. I mean, you talked about the breastfeeding aspect, but you also say, Susan, that infants form the brain circuitry with this face-to-face or with this touching contact, and even how their genetic programming will play out. What does that mean?
Well, it essentially means that all of us inherit, you know, a certain pattern of genetic predispositions for various diseases, in fact, and patterns of behavior. But whether or not we come to experience those conditions has a lot to do with our environment and what kind of upbringing we've had. And what some epidemiologists are learning is that it's not just the genetic predisposition a child has, but what kind of parental experience he has or she has. So, for example, you can have a certain marker for violence as a child, especially if you're a boy. But only if you've experienced neglect or abuse as a child will this genetic marker actually be revealed as a genetic pattern, as a behavioral pattern. Mm-hmm. And that is just amazing to me. And there is some research done by somebody in the Midwest named Guang Guo, who shows that it's not even just parents, but if you take identical twins who have this genetic marker for aggression or violence, and you divide them in two groups, and one group of identical twins gets a fabulous teacher who connects with them, that teacher can stave off the pattern of aggressive behavior just by forming a bond with that child. And so I think we've totally underestimated the impact that parents and teachers can have on children in favor of shiny, jewel-like technology.
And what about the parents of infants? You talk about the brain circuitry of the infant being affected. What about the brain circuitry of the parent, or is it too late for that to be affected?
I think that essentially it's a two-way street. I mean, I wouldn't say that being, you know, there is some evidence that mothers who have more contact with their babies are smarter and solve problems better. That's for sure. And that is, I think, part of the hormonal impact of close mm-hmm. contact with your baby. I mean, they've shown it with all sorts of species, you know, all the way up the phylogenetic ladder. But what's really important is that, for example, if you don't have that face-to-face time, there's all sorts of impact on both the parent and the child. For one thing, there are many fewer words directed to that child from adults. So there's, for every hour of, like, media entertainment that's on, that means any kind of screen that's on in a room, Andrew Meltzoff and Christakis, two researchers, found that the more screen sounds in the room, the less speech an adult directs to the child, and the lower that child's vocabulary as he or she nears schooling. So there's less also, if the child is going to speak less to the parent will respond less. So it's kind of like a give and take, to and fro.
I found that sometimes meeting youngsters who are so totally immersed in their cell phones and texting and chat and social media have really difficulty maintaining a meaningful conversation with someone and even avoid eye contact. Is that widespread?
I think it's widespread. I think if you're talking about teenagers have never been geniuses at communicating with older adults, and I don't think there's a lot of motivation there. They're more interested in their peer group. So I hesitate to place a lot of blame on the devices, but I will say that social skills need to be practiced like anything else, and the more you practice, the better you are at it. And you have to make eye contact and look at someone to have empathy for that person. And empathy is something that needs to be practiced as well, and some people need more training than others. So I would say that for people and kids or teens who find it difficult, then it's much easier to look down at your screen. And I think adults are guilty of this all the time. you know, if you want to avoid a conflict, how many of us haven't turned to our email or phone so we don't have to pay attention to somebody we're with in that moment, or we don't have to resolve something quickly? So it's not just children and teenagers, and I would say, moreover, the people who are making decisions about this, is they're really people who are in positions of power and policy making. So who's putting the phones in the hands of those kids, actually? It's really adults.
What would you repeat what you just said about empathy, that you have to look in somebody's eyes in order to feel empathy?
Yes, I think that there are two kinds of empathy, essentially. There's what's called emotional empathy and cognitive empathy. You know, emotional empathy is when you feel somebody else's pain.
Right.
And sometimes that leads to you acting in an appropriate way. You know, if everybody went around and were feeling everybody's pain, then when everybody cried, you'd cry too, and that's not always appropriate.
Right.
But often it leads us to make the right noises and say the right things and do the right things. And that's why, for example, people are more altruistic when they see somebody who's suffering right in front of them, because they feel empathy for them. That's emotional empathy. Cognitive empathy is when you can imagine somebody else. Like, for example, I imagine you sitting in your studio right now with a microphone just, you know, 8 inches from your face and with a headset on. That's cognitive empathy, where I can, even though I can't see you, I can imagine the position that you're in and what the weather might be like in Miami, even though it's below zero where I am, right? But essentially, it takes a lot of practice for both of those skills to see somebody in person to develop those skills, especially for those of us who may not be as well endowed from birth with empathy. They're not. Some of us are just not as good at it. Some of us are better. So, for example, in my last book, which is about sex differences, we do know that there are more women than men who are naturally good at emotional empathy. They just can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is why they cry in movies. They just can't help but empathize with characters or with people that they see in the here and now. And there's a reason for that that I go into. But essentially, if you don't see anybody, if you're removed, then it's really hard to develop empathy for those people.
We're speaking with Susan Pinker on today's Topical Currents. Her latest book is The Village Effect. One more short break, and we'll return.
And we're back, 46 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist and developmental psychologist Susan Pinker with you. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. If you'd like to get in, you should hurry because we only have about 15 minutes left. Tell me, Susan Pinker, isn't there sort of a widespread cultural approval of the loner? I'm thinking of the brooding creative types, the William Faulkners, Franz Kafka or Steinbeck.
Van Gogh.
You know,
Van Gogh.
Yeah, I think you're putting your finger on a kind of romantic, rugged individualism that's part of the American identity. And, you know, it was kind of put in very stark terms by the comedian George Burns when he quipped, "Happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city." I mean, we are, it is very much lauded that we are loners. And interestingly, not all cultures live this way. And one of the, I guess, experiences that sparked this book, and one of the stories I tell in this book, is that when I was trying to figure out why it was that, you know, women live longer lives than men do, and I knew it had something to do with social contact, I was sitting in a dark lecture hall when I learned this amazing fact, that there was one place in the world where men live as long as women, and not only that, there are a huge number of long livers, in particular centenarians. People live well into their 90s and 100s and even beyond, and I thought, I have to go to that place and find out what's going on. And these are remote villages in Sardinia, which is a part of Italy, where there are 10 times as many centenarians as there are in the United States. And when I got there, I went there with my daughter, in fact, and I got there and I found something that caused us great frustration at the beginning, which is that none of the centenarians was ever left alone. They were always surrounded by a tight web of kith and kin, like an unending parade of people stopping by to chat and cook and provide some personal care, a kiss on the cheek, a story, gossip, etc. And this is confirmed by the studies that I later, you know, researched, that essentially people who experience various types of social contact have an increased odds of survival. But that's sort of not part of the American narrative. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to change or tweak a little bit with this book, that it should be part of our narrative, and a lot of people kind of need a little wake-up call.
Susan, another thing, according to your research, you said the village effect can go wild, as you put it, which sometimes leads to unfortunate or detrimental outcomes. So something about the negative effects of the village, and what are those?
Well, essentially, we're clannish as human beings, and we form in-groups and out-groups. And when we are with our in-group, there's sort of a shortcut to trusting these people. And we kind of turn off our ability to evaluate whether or not they're really on our side, because it kind of short-circuits our ability to ask ourselves the deep questions. So it's really about the fact that when we underestimate the power of social contact, we can get into deep trouble. And in the book, I tell the story of many communities that have suffered from affinity fraud. Affinity fraud is when people are defrauding others in their own ethnic group. So, of course, everybody knows about Bernie Madoff,
right, but
it happens in every single ethnic group. So, you know, they're like Lebanese Arabs who are defrauding other Lebanese Arabs. They're Mennonites who are defrauding Mennonites. And essentially, this is the power of social contact, is that it's hugely influential on us. Most of the influences are beneficial. And that reminds me, as I did come across the statistic I was looking for earlier, which is that if you're married as a man, if you're unmarried, I should say, single or divorced men are 250% more likely to die young or die prematurely than married men are at any age. And unmarried women are 50% more likely to die young than married women. So we underestimate how influential this is on us, because it mostly is invisible to us. It passes under our radar. So whether it's a question of thinking seriously about the people in our in-group and asking ourselves the serious questions, because it's not about that this is an unalloyed good, face-to-face contact. It's more that it's hugely powerful.
I guess we'll have to see if the marriage rates spike from your book.
Well, you know, I would say that writing this book had a transformative effect on my own habits, which I didn't expect. So, you know, spending 4 years learning about this stuff changed the way I lived my life day to day.
Let's take another phone call before we close. This is Laura. She's in Boca Raton. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Susan. I love the talk today. It's wonderful. I agree with everything you were saying. And I wish I read your book 20-something years ago. I would feel different back then. Coming from Israel, coming from a big family, having lots of aunts and uncles and siblings and being very social and out there, coming to America and feeling very lonely, living on the 9th floor and not knowing my neighbor for a whole year. I felt very isolated when it came to living in America, and I thought people really don't have the skill of socializing. When I had my kids, I really emphasized on all the points that you were saying, encouraging them today to get married young, to have that partner like I do, and how it helped me to achieve that, all the things that you said that can be prevented and all the benefits from it. So I just wanted to thank you for waking up America and making people go out there, be socializing, doing the right things. I think that's very important.
You know, I have just one little comment about that, which is that certain cultures are much more social, as you mentioned. And when I went to give a talk in Israel a few years ago, I was very surprised to walk down the street and have strangers talk to me, which happens to me in New York City, too. There are certain places that are just friendlier to people, whether you're an insider or an outsider. Whereas, you know, I would say that in a lot of places in North America, for sure, if you start talking to a stranger, you'd be thought of as a weirdo. But I would like to sort of encourage people to have casual conversations to kind of foster that middle layer, because really getting to know your neighbors and the people you cross paths with, even if it's just your hallway in your apartment building or the coffee shop or the library, those can turn into real friendships.
Well, in our last couple of minutes, Susan, why don't you talk about more of these six principles that we might consider using to build our face-to-face connections?
Yeah, well, let's start talking about neighbors. You know, I have been in Florida a couple of times in the last year, and one of the features of many kind of South Floridian environments is that there are a lot of cars, but not too many people on the sidewalks, and that people don't really know and talk to their neighbors that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so to foster the village effect, I think you really have to make an effort to do it, to talk to your neighbors, to form relationships with them, and to structure social time into your day, just as the way you would structure in exercise, for example. A lot of people I saw walking or cycling, you know, or playing golf, but not talking to anybody. You know, so find a way to get to know people, whether it's taking a course, whether it's, you know, going to the same cafe at the same time every single day, or volunteering. That neighborhood social contact is really, really important. At work, if you're working, build real human contact into your workday. Get up and talk to your colleagues. See your clients and partners face-to-face at least every year or 18 months. And for kids, make sure that you put a lot of emphasis on face-to-face contact. Structure it in through, I would say, daily meals, family meals. Control how much time kids spend online. I would be surprised about, you know, parents who would allow their kids to eat, say, an O. Henry bar three times a day, yet, you know, American kids are spending an average of 7 hours in front of a screen, more than any amount of time they spend on any activity except sleeping. So I think parents are, because it's convenient for them, not really putting any limits on this, and instead of ramping up their screen time gradually as they get older. And at times of stress, real contact with kids. No texting, because we know that texting has no impact on their stress levels. I would say for education, to look for classrooms for old and young that foster the face-to-face, not remote education, and not to use technology as a way to increase class sizes. One of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about was the fact that I think that digital education is increasing the class divide, because people who can afford it are spending the money on smaller classes and brick-and-mortar types of education.
Well, we have to be running.
Pardon me?
We have to be running. We'll address that topic at another time.
I hope we do.
Okay, we'll have a link to Susan Pinker's book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And Susan Pinker is a developmental psychologist and journalist who also wrote The Sexual Paradox. Thanks so much for joining us, Susan.
Thank you.
And thanks you for tuning in. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive, technical supervision and online information from Paul Leary. If you're a condo resident, either owner or renter, you'll want to join us for tomorrow's program. We'll be at your service with attorney and regular contributor Donna Berger. Perhaps your property is governed by a homeowners association or co-op. Some issues are what's behind the term due diligence. Are videotaped association meetings okay? And can associations have an English-only rule? Tomorrow, free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, link, discussion, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.